Let's go ahead and call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association to order. Roll call, please.
Donna Riley?
Here.
Jim DeMartini?
Here.
Michael O'Neill?
Here.
Jeff Grover?
Here.
Mandeep Dillon?
Here.
Mike Lynch?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Present.
Gordon Ford?
Jigun Raja Paul Gordon Ford here.
Sam Sharp?
Here.
Joan Clendenon? We have a quorum.
Okay, item number three, announcements.
We do, Chair. I have a couple of longevity awards, I guess I could call in to give out to staff. And if we can get, first of all, Teresa Clayton to stand up. So this is where I'm presenting a 20-year of service to the people of Stanislaus County to Teresa Clayton. Teresa's been with us for about a year now, but she's got 20 years, obviously, of county service. She came to us from the district attorney's office, and she has been a very pleasant addition to our staff regarding members as they come in. She sometimes is the first person that the first face that the members see when they come in, and she's very pleasant to work with. So I want to thank you and congratulate you for your 20 years of service.
Thank you.
They want to get a picture, I guess.
This way, guys.
There we go.
Thank you.
And our second recognition is for Natalie Elliott for 15 years of service to Stanislaus County. Natalie has been here for about 11 years with Stansera, but it has been broken up. She had originally started here in
2004.
And how long did you work?
Until 2010. Came back in 2013.
So you evidently missed us.
I did. I'm so happy I came back.
Natalie is really great. She works on a lot of complicated issues for us. She does the GASB reporting with employers, and she has really made tremendous strides in understanding and breaking down alternative fee structures and reporting for us and reconciliation. So we're very thankful to have Natalie here, and congratulations on 15 years.
Thank you, everybody.
Okay, are there any further announcements? Perfect. Hearing none, any public comment? I don't see anyone from the public here, otherwise our prior Board of Supervisor member, but I don't think he has anything he wants to add. Nope. All right. So, consent calendar. Does any board member wish to pull anything from the consent calendar? Hearing none. I just have one on the regular service retirements, number 51. Just a question for Vivian Sweatman. It's indicated as safety personnel. Is that just because she's employed by the Sheriff's Department? Because I think the position she's in is not safety per se.
No, it should have been classified.
As a general member?
These should only be asterisked if they are actually a safety member. So I will check on that.
Okay, so that's the only question I had. Other than that, hearing none, I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent calendar as agendized.
Motion to approve.
Second. Okay. Motion by Michael O'Neill, second by Jeff Grover. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Okay, we'll now move on to item 6A, the PIMCO report.
As she gets that ready, we're slowly trying to figure this out, and we're making great strides in getting good at getting this technology up and running. So hopefully we have no glitches today.
We did test it with PIMCO. They should be on the line. They were expecting us somewhere between 1:30 and 1:35. Welcome to the board meeting.
Good afternoon. Can you hear us okay?
We can.
Wow, fantastic. We are super impressed by the technological prowess of this board.
Trust me, it's not the board.
And you can see us okay as well?
Yes.
Very good, yes.
I don't see how that, with Sasha's exception, with the exception of Sasha, I don't see how seeing I'm on Matt are necessarily a plus this meeting. You know, we're happy, you can see us in good shape.
Yep. The first is we're happy for the opportunity to be here. I think I've met many of the folks in the room, but for those I haven't met yet, I'm Sasha Talcott. I'm an account manager in PIMCO's Newport Beach office here in Southern California. To my left is my partner in crime covering the Stackers plans, or many of the Stackers plans, with me, Matt Clark. Matt is also an account manager in our Newport Beach office covering exclusively public plans. We've also asked Anmol if you might join. Anmol is a key specialist on our total return team. I'm working on corp bond portfolios, so we thought it would be helpful for him to lend his expertise to the meeting as well. What we thought would be most helpful, and really we can take this in any direction that the board would like to go in. We thought it would be most helpful to first just give a brief market review, as well as portfolio performance and positioning. Second, we can talk a little bit about our economic outlook, if helpful. And third, if this board desires, we're happy to give an update on PIMCO as an organization as well. Was anything in there sort of sound of higher interest or of lower interest?
I'd just like to see you talk about maybe briefly the economic outlook from PIMCO's perspective, and probably not so much on performance. And then if there's, I've noticed that there's been a couple stories in the news about a particular lawsuit. You might want to comment on that. That'd be great.
We would be happy to address all of those. Do we still have about 20 minutes?
Yeah, we'd like to wrap this up by no later than 2, guys.
Okay, perfect. We will do that. So first, before we get rolling on those, we just want to say thank you. You've been a client of ours since 2010. We deeply appreciated the partnership with this board, with Stan Sara. We're aware that, of course, with the change in asset allocation, this portfolio will ultimately be going away, but and we really just wanted to convey how much we've enjoyed the relationship and this board, and you know, hope to have the opportunity at some point in the future to work with you again. So with that, let me turn it to Anmol to address some of those key things.
Great. Thank you very much for taking the time. And thank you again. I'm just echoing Sasha's comments. I don't think I've ever done quite this level of video conference before, but please feel free to interrupt if I'm too loud or too low, or if you have any questions. I think the preference was to not cover too much performance. Maybe just quickly touching on 2016 broadly, it was a very interesting year. If you have the presentation in front of you, maybe if one page that may be of interest, if you turn to page 7, this just shows you returns for different asset classes. The solid bars show you what happened in the fourth quarter, and the gradient bar shows you what happened in the year. And I guess from a market perspective, maybe just a few things to highlight for the year. Certainly an interesting one in the sense that a lot of what people would have said were the baseline expectations didn't really transpire. But interestingly, the market outcomes that occurred as a result of non-baseline events were also unusual. And if we had to characterize the year, I would probably point out 3 inflection points. One happened in the first quarter of 2016, which involved, I don't know if you remember this far back now, most market participants don't, but in the first quarter of 2016, you actually had all sorts of risk assets underperform. There was a big fear in markets that recession was around the corner. It was really precipitated by oil prices falling again, as well as China, some jitters about whether the Chinese economy was doing poorly. That changed pretty dramatically after February, when all of a sudden markets realized, hey, nothing in the actual data seems to show recession. And so then you saw a very big rally after that in most risk assets, equities, credit bonds, everything. If you fast forward to second quarter, at the end of second quarter, you had the Brexit referendum, which was another big surprise event because markets expected it to end with the UK staying as part of the European Union. That was, of course, not the outcome. Markets reacted adversely for probably about 5 days until they realized this is also going to be a very long, drawn-out process, and markets generally rallied again. The last inflection point, of course, was the U.S. election. The baseline was not for a Trump victory. Of course, a Trump victory materialized, but what was almost as interesting was the fact that the markets reacted very positively. Usually surprises the negative reaction to markets. And in this case, there was a lot of focus on the potential for deregulation, for tax reform, and of course, fiscal stimulus, all being very positive for growth. And I outline that because that really then filters into what you've seen so far this year, is that generally equity markets, credit bonds, everything have been performing fairly well on the notion that we should get positive growth outcomes as a result of really those three main things, again, being deregulation, tax cuts, and fiscal stimulus. So that's kind of the backdrop of where we are today. The one reason I kept mentioning the risk assets too is important to keep in mind that you have a question about fundamentals, and then you have some of where valuations stand. And really, when you think about where stocks are today, where corporate bonds are, things are fairly, in our opinion, richly valued. But there's been a lot of expectation for positive growth, and therefore, financial markets have done fairly well. So this is kind of the backdrop we live in. You can see some of the bigger moves, as I mentioned, on page 7. Here, maybe just a few things to point out. You know, I talked about those inflection points, and yet you see, for example, in the bottom right panel, S&P 500 equity markets were up 12%. Emerging market stocks, which is MSCI EM there, was up nearly 12% as well. So pretty strong year, despite some big surprises. So maybe just turning to your second point on just outlook, and then from there we can maybe transition to PIMCO. Chart we can talk about is page 18. And I'll give you a little bit of background on our views on the world so far. Forgive me if we use these, you know, we talk, people don't have the most excitement in our world, so we try to come up with cool headlines, but all we came up for this one was Into the Unknown. But broadly speaking, you know, at PIMCO, we look at what is the trajectory of the world, let's say, for a longer time period, 3 to 5 years or so. And then every quarter we evaluate within that 3 to 5 year framework, where is the economy headed, or where is the world economy headed over the next year? So to give you kind of a background, for the next 3 to 5 years, our phrase, if you will, for where global growth and inflation and trends are, is really this concept of stable but not secure. That generally growth globally has been doing well, but it's been very much supported by a lot of coordinated central bank activity. And that is maybe starting to diminish a little bit, given that central banks are reaching limits of how much they can support economies. Now, with that in mind, and kind of the election outcomes and things that we saw happen in the US, what we had framed our last outlook around, this is actually from December, you can see this notion, and again, this is getting a little bit into the weeds of statistics, but you can see the curve here, and basically it's supposed to represent what outcomes can occur for growth. And what you see is that the market has been focused on what we call the right tail, so better than expected growth outcomes. We at PIMCO do agree that there is a higher likelihood now than there was previously of positive growth outcomes, but maybe as important is the idea that you could have some negative growth outcomes with left tail. And that's what we highlight here. You can see some of the details of why we think both tails are what we call fatter, so there's more of a probability of either one occurring. The basic idea for us from an investment perspective is, given this level of uncertainty, we want to be a little bit more defensively positioned. You know, our CIO, Dan Iveson, tends to use this phrase, you have to respect the uncertainty. And if you think about where we stand today, while there's a lot of optimism in markets, there's still not as much clarity about the timing and the ultimate evolution of policy in the US. And then if you think about Europe, there are French elections coming up, which will be followed right after by German elections. And then later on this year, there's actually China's National Party Congress, which will dictate kind of the political future for China as well. So if you think about the levels of uncertainty ahead and how full valuations are, we think it's better at this point in time to be a little bit more guarded, a little bit more defensive, which means that from a positioning perspective, we're trying to be higher up in quality, favor a little bit more liquidity. And we think, you know, you're going to likely see lots of pockets of volatility because central banks have stepped back a little bit, which means we want to be well positioned to take advantage of that. Because that's usually where you see market dislocations and where active managers like PIMCO have added value in the past, where we think we've hopefully added value in your portfolio for the last few years. So really, that's kind of it. In a very short summary, that's really our outlook, that a lot of potential for good things to happen, but you have to respect the uncertainty, and given current market levels, we'll probably want to be a little bit more defensive. Let me pause there. If there's any questions.
Yeah, are you thinking of tinkering around the edges in terms of duration, given the state of your views going forward?
Yeah, so you said in terms of duration.
Right.
Yeah, so interest rate positioning is interesting. Of course, you saw a pretty dramatic increase right after the elections that happened in the U.S. Now, we of course didn't, that wasn't our baseline that you would see a Trump victory and then a huge rise in rates. But one of the biggest drivers of rates moving higher was inflation expectations moving higher. And that was something that we, in your portfolio, but also in core portfolios broadly, were positioned for. So we think that rates are likely to be a little bit range-bound. But despite the fact that you've seen this big move up, they're only likely to modestly move a little bit higher. And to the extent they do, they're going to move because of inflation expectations. So while we will tinker with duration, the bigger conviction is really this idea that you have to have inflation protection. So we use things like inflation-protected securities in the U.S. And that's been our conviction. That was very beneficial to us the last few months, so we've moderated the positioning a little bit. But that's probably one of the bigger changes we've made more recently.
So you feel that investors then will still kind of, in terms of demand, will flock to the lower end of the curve then?
So in terms of on the curve, the front end actually had a pretty dramatic repricing given the nuance of the curve, the front end of the yield curve is the part that's most impacted by the Fed moving. So that's a little bit different than how the rest of the curve moves. At the front end, we had for some time been avoiding it in terms of Treasury exposure because we thought markets were being a little bit too apathetic with respect to how much the Fed could move. That dramatically repriced over the last few months as they realized, and of course the Fed moved this month, but they realized that the Fed is likely to move going forward, and therefore the front end recalibrated. You saw prices fall, rates rise, and now we think it's about fair value there. The reason we're not worried about rates rising too much is if you think about where U.S. is relative to Europe or to Japan or even to the U.K., U.S. rates have moved dramatically higher where the rest of the world really hasn't. So there's only, you know, U.S. is not on an island, right? You can only stretch that rubber band so far. So we think that U.S. is relatively attractive from a rate perspective. Also remember that anytime there's bouts of uncertainty, people tend to flock to treasuries generally. It's probably the middle of the curve if you think about where. So if people are going to be, the fact that U.S. rates are even more attractive relative to global rates means that that safe haven property is enhanced.
Thanks. Thank you.
Would it be helpful, I know, Rick, I think you mentioned you didn't want us to delve too deeply into performance. Would it be helpful to give just a brief overview of how the portfolio has performed and also some of the key drivers of that performance, or otherwise we can skip right to a PIMCO update.
Sure, go ahead. We have a few more minutes.
Okay. Yeah, let me know if I'm rambling too much. I'm going to try to keep it short. In terms of performance, the portfolio did fairly well in 2016, and I can point you to the page here. Page 12, you can see the performance metrics for your portfolio. The bars on top show you annual performance. And the table on the bottom shows you performance across different periods. So, and just to give you some sense, so in terms of numbers, in 2016, the account returned roughly 3.4% after fees, whereas the benchmark in the same period returned 2.65. So you had about 75 basis points of alpha. In terms of the biggest drivers for the portfolio, one was certainly the thematic. We had a lot of focus on, again, the inflation protection. That was a big driver of performance. And then in terms of credit, that was the other big contributor to performance. The portfolio had a focus on sectors we like, things like financial, some telecom, as well as actually some higher quality dollar-denominated emerging market debt. And those in tandem were probably the biggest drivers of performance for 2016. If you think about, you know, what have been drivers so far, the portfolio has been doing decently well so far this year. We continue to think things like some inflation protection, as well as de-emphasizing sectors that are more linked to central bank support, focusing in on things like consumer sectors or even housing-related sectors that we think are still poised to perform well, given that housing, for example, is doing very well and is a little bit separated from all of the concerns in the global economy.
Okay. Eric, should we shift to PIMCO, please? Unless there are any questions on performance.
Nope, go ahead.
Well, you alluded to it at the very start, and actually where to begin, where Sasha began, thank you again for the longstanding trust and confidence in us. I say that at the outset because you all have been with us through some very interesting period over the history of PIMCO. I'd say that the organizational development that started around 2014 really came to a close yesterday. We issued a joint press statement with Bill Gross, announcing the resolution of the legal matter that he had brought when he departed PIMCO. As you might recall, by way of background, Bill Gross had initiated a lawsuit against PIMCO, basically asserting that he was wrongfully terminated. The gist of the resolution is that we have settled with Bill, and Bill settled with us. Our press release and his press release noted that it was an amicable settlement. The terms, of course, are confidential to both parties, but what was put in the press release was that any sort of monetary compensation that would come back to Bill, Bill intends to donate to charity, along with some additional resources that he'll be donating on a personal basis. We also have agreed to name a conference room here at PIMCO after Bill in honor of his role as a founder of the organization. And in addition to that, he'll have a role of director emeritus with the PIMCO Foundation. Again, all of this was included in our public press announcement. From your perspective, really no impact at all on PIMCO. We had provisioned for this outcome for quite some time, and in no way impacts our ability to retain and to hire investment talent. And along those lines, we've been very encouraged by the folks that we've added to the team. I think the most significant of those was Manny Roman, who joined as the new CEO in November of last year. He's really emphasized a business strategy that looks to build out areas of the organization that are complementary to what you know us well for. So things like private debt, private credit, as well as quantitative strategies, these are all part and parcel to what we've been doing at PIMCO for many, many years, and we're trying to make sure that we provide those sorts of services to clients who are interested, you know, perhaps like Stan and Sarah, should that become an area of interest for you all in the future. Let me pause and maybe Sasha's anything or Anmol that you'd like to add in terms of the update.
Any questions?
Sounds good.
Questions?
Any questions? Nope, hearing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. Well, again, we're just deeply appreciative of the relationship, of the partnership, and of the time that this board has put in, really over the last 5+ years of partnership. So thank you again.
Thank you.
All right, folks, good luck with the rest of your discussions and the rest of the week.
Thank you, Matt.
Now we're going to try and disconnect. We'll start by muting ourselves.
It worked really well.
Yeah, there's still a few glitches, but we're getting better at it.
No.
But if you close the window.
It's still on.
Leaving meeting.
Yeah.
There we go.
This could be embarrassing.
I know.
Would it help if they made a conference room after us? No, just kidding.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
It sounds like there wasn't damages.
81 million bucks, they say.
The press release says 81 million.
That's what I saw.
He's going to donate it to charity.
That's what the article said. I saw it.
We ready to go with LSV?
They will be ready on a hard line here at 2, so okay. Hopefully they're on there.
These guys have had a good last year.
Oh, yeah.
Last half of the year, anyway.
Yes, one of them is out of the country and unable to purchase that video wise.
It is quite a big leap.
Yeah.
Yep.
We're going old school with them.
You guys want Chicago? We'll get Chicago.
This is Swami. Is that where it goes?
Yeah.
Stand still. Hi, you're on line with Stan Sarah Board. Let me put you on speaker. Just one moment. You're welcome. Can you hear us okay?
Yes. How about you? Can you hear us okay?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Fantastic. Swami and I are in two different places, so we'll do your best to speak up. But first of all, good afternoon. We appreciate you including us in the agenda today. And just by brief introductions, we've met probably most of you in the room, but there might be a few new people from the last time we presented or met. My name is Keith Brook, and I serve as Director of Client Service, a partner at LSV, and with me on the phone is Bhaskaran Swaminathan, goes by Swami, and he is our Director of Research and one of the senior members of the investment team. So I assume you have the presentation in front of you, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Great. We will spend maybe 15 minutes on comments, quick update on the organization. Swami will spend a few minutes just reviewing our philosophy and process to give us a little bit of a base for a discussion of recent performance and the current portfolio structure and outlook for the portfolio and for kind of the overall market. But as we kind of go through the presentation, please stop at any point if you have questions, and we'll leave plenty of time for any of your questions at the end. Let me start maybe on page one. If you flip to page one, we have a couple of pages on organizational update. And as usual, there's not a whole lot new to report, no significant changes to the organization, but I do want to comment on a few items. First of all, you'll remember that we are structured as a partnership, and that we added one new partner at the end of the year. So now there are 30 partners who share in the ownership of the firm. SEI, who helped us get started over 20 years ago as a kind of venture capital and putting up seed capital, still owns a minority stake in the firm, but there's no change to their involvement or ownership percentage. So no changes there other than having an additional partner at year end. Also, it's I think it's important to know we had a routine SEC examination last year. The SEC came in June, and it was the first time since I think 08 that, that we had a visit from the SEC, and no deficiencies or violations were noted in the exam. So essentially a clean exam, which doesn't happen all that often, fully understand. And we're happy to share the letter that we received from the SEC with you. But I just wanted to mention that from last year. As far as the business, you know, no changes to our our offerings. You know, we've had cash flows into your strategy last year, positive cash flows in to from the about $1 billion, and right now we manage about $20 billion in international, you know, large cap value assets. So kind of up with the market plus some positive cash flows. So no significant changes to kind of the business. On page two, this should look familiar to you. No changes to the investment team, the senior team of Joseph, Mano, Puneet, Swami, and the rest of the team. So I won't belabor the point, but we don't expect to see any changes to the to the senior team. We may add some junior maybe quantitative analysts to the team, but our senior team and the group that's worked together for a number of years remains intact, and we don't expect to see any changes. So let me stop there, see if there's any questions on the organization.
Nope.
If not, and we can always circle back if there anything comes up, I will turn it over to Swami to kind of give a brief review of our process and philosophy before we go into performance and how the portfolio is structured.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for your professionalism and your business. On page five, you can turn to the expected return model, which kind of lists out the major components of our approach. As you know well, we are a value investor. We like to refer to ourselves as a deep value investor. By that we mean that we like to buy companies that are significantly cheaper than the benchmarks. Just to give you a quick idea of what I mean by deep value, if you turn to page 10, you will see some portfolio characteristics for this portfolio as of the end of February. And you can see on the SANSOS portfolio evaluation multiples on price to forward earnings, FY1 being the consensus sell-side analyst forecast, FY2, price to forward earnings 2 years out, price to cash flow. You can see the portfolio is trading at significant discounts, not just to the core benchmark, the MSCI ACWI ex-US, but also to the value benchmark. So typically our portfolio is trading at significant discounts to the value benchmark also, and that's why we call ourselves a deep value investor. So going back to page five, we like to think of ourselves as really replicating the best fundamental investing practices using a quant approach. We are a quant investor, but we are very fundamentally based. We think like fundamental investors. We use all fundamental information about a company, financial statements, balance sheet, income statements, statement of cash flows, all the corporate financial policy, capital structure policy, dividend policy, stock buyback program. We study all those things, but we do this in a quantitative way. We collect all the data, through databases. We process them, we analyze them. At the end of the day, what we're trying to do is figure out how cheap or expensive a company is. But we do this in a systematic way. We try to keep the human emotions out of the process. We think that way we are not attracted to individual names. We don't get carried away by one name or the other. We try to be very disciplined and kind of clinical about how we go about picking companies. Keep the human biases out of the process. That's kind of the fundamental way, philosophy behind everything that we do. The three major components of our model on page five, we like companies that are very cheap, but we also like companies which are very profitable. So we like profitable companies that are cheap. Sometimes you'll find companies that are cheap for a very good reason, because they're not profitable anymore. You can think of Sears, or you can think of JCPenney. we like companies that are profitable, not just in terms of accounting profits, but also cash flow. Because the cash flow, cash is king. We pay a lot of attention to cash flows, operating cash flows. A company with strong operating cash flows, high profitability, strong earnings, yet it's very cheap because maybe the market is too pessimistic about the stock. And those are the kind of companies we like to buy. So if you look at the first block, cheapness, there are five different valuation groups in it: cash flow, earnings, dividend yield, book and sales. So we like to look at valuation from multiple angles, not just one or the other, but we give the most importance to cash flows and earnings, and that's why they are at the top of the list. So 60% of the weight in our model goes to cash flow-based valuation metrics, such as cash flow to price, EBITDA to enterprise value, forward earnings to price, dividend yield, book-to-market ratios, and so on. The second important piece for us is that because we are contrarians, we are long-term investors, we go against the trend. We like companies that have actually underperformed over a fairly long period. We like companies who are becoming more mature in their life cycle. Their growth rates are slowing down, but they're becoming more like cash cows. And they're also underperforming the market because people are not as excited by them anymore. We like those companies. So that's the second piece, the contrarian piece, and that is 15% of the weight in the model. Think of it like it's a hockey stick. So the long-term underperformance represents the long arm of the hockey stick. Then it's kind of bottomed out, so it's very cheap. But we also want to see some evidence of recovery in prices and fundamentals over the last 3, 6, 9 months before we will buy this company. So that is the last piece, the momentum piece. So we like underperforming companies that are very cheap, yet very profitable with strong cash flows, but there is now recent evidence of a recovery in earnings, in profits, in kind of the sell-side analyst expectations, in terms of price momentum, the prices are beginning to improve. So that's kind of the optimistic analogy I gave you. So those are the three important things. 60% weight goes to cheapness, 15% goes to contrarian, and 25% goes to momentum, and that's kind of how the model is constructed. The 60, 15, 25 doesn't change. We are always going to give most weight to cash flows and most weight to valuation and kind of a little bit weight to momentum so that we are not buying value trap companies, companies that kind of look cheap, but they're actually on their way down. So we're trying to avoid that, kind of trying to not catch a falling knife. So those are the three important pieces, and the model is expected return model is constructed based on these characteristics, and then we rank companies based on this expected return model. So let me just pause for a second and see if you have any questions on the model.
So at what point does it become too expensive for you? And what do? You sell them, the stocks, or?
Yes, so the way we look at expensiveness versus cheapness is in terms of how these stocks are ranked in our model based on expected return. So if you turn to page 6, for example, there's a value investment process. So there's obviously in the Acqui universe, there's a lot of stocks, about 34,000 stocks. We screen it for cap and liquidity, at least $500 million in market cap, average daily trading volume of $1 million. We screen it for cap and liquidity. So we end up with a universe of 3,800 stocks across many different countries. And our approach is also very country neutral in the sense that we are trying to pick the best companies in every country. So when we rank these countries based on the expected return model, typically when we construct a new portfolio, we are focusing on the highest ranked names, the top 15%, right? So those are the stocks that we like. We think of the best that we are going to take to our optimizer. But once the portfolio is constructed, the buy range, as I said, is top 15%. Our whole range is top 40%. So as long as the stock is ranked in the top 40% of the universe, it's still cheap, but not as cheap as it once was, we'll hold it. But when the stock falls below the top 40%, that's when it begins to get an expensive range for us. At that point in time, when we rebalance the portfolio, which is roughly once in 8 weeks, we will replace that name that has fallen out of the top 40% because it's now relatively more expensive with a stock that is in the top 15%. So expensiveness for us is relative to its position in the overall universe of stocks. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So again, on page 6, so you start with the 3,800 stock universe. You take the top 15%, which is a 550 stock buy list that comes across all these countries and different sectors and industries. We take it to our mean variance optimizer. We're trying to construct a portfolio with the highest expected return for a tracking error of around 5%, tracking error being what is the risk budget in terms of how much the portfolio can deviate from the benchmark, relative to the benchmark. we put in reasonable sector constraints, industry constraints, so that you don't take too much of a sector bet or industry bet, not more than plus or minus 5% for sectors, not more than plus or minus 4% for industries and some industries. Don't take big bets on any one name. So the whole approach is to buy attractive companies which are cheap, which have strong cash flows, strong earnings, reasonable momentum, but diversify them across individual names, sectors, industries, and countries so that you have a portfolio that is, you know, that is stable over time and can outperform in a stable way over time. So it kind of provides a kind of a safety, margin of safety in terms of how this portfolio is constructed for our investors. And you can see on page 7 the self-discipline which I already referred to, you know, buy in the top 15%, hold in the top 40%, sell if it drops out of the top 40%. Or if an individual name, because it's done very well, it become very big. You know, if the portfolio weight exceeds benchmark weight by 1.5% for small cap stocks and 2.5% for large cap stocks, trim them back. So don't let one or two or three names dominate the portfolio. So make sure the portfolio is always diversified. So this approach is a very low turnover approach. It's a low transaction cost approach. You know, portfolio turnover is typically in 20 to 30% range. So it's a long-term investment approach, patient approach. Buy good companies with strong cash flows, profitable companies, and hold them for a period of time and outperform the market using this approach.
With that, maybe we can turn to performance. Maybe a quick comment on page 8. We have a lot of numbers here. Basically, it's the return of the different benchmarks through February 28th. And just the one comment that I make as far as background for our discussion of performance is in the last couple of meetings where we've met with you, we've talked a little bit about a more difficult environment for value, particularly in 2014 and 2015. But as Swami pointed out, we stick to our discipline, which helps us kind of keep up in those markets and actually do fairly well given our deep value approach is that we put a lot of weight on cash flow and we have companies that are generating cash flow earnings. They're not distressed type of companies. But you'll see in this column 1 year, the last year, and kind of where we highlighted the MSCI EV value versus growth spread, you see a positive number. And what that indicates is that value did well last year and over the last 12 months. In fact, value outperformed growth by almost 10% last year after a number of years of lagging, as you can see, the 2 year, 3 year, 5 year, and 10 year with value underperforming a bit. So it was a good environment for us. In 2016, and we took advantage of that, it was really across the board. It wasn't just in developed markets, but also you see emerging value did well, but also emerging in general, emerging stocks, emerging markets had lagged for a number of years, and we're country neutral, so we're not taking bets on countries. When we have a nice exposure to emerging markets, but it's in line with the benchmark. It's difficult to time these, and I think last year was a good example of that with countries like Brazil and Russia doing extremely well. Some people souring on emerging markets earlier in the year, but have over the last 12 months have been really the best place to be, particularly emerging markets value. So with that, on page 9, we have the performance displayed across the top as the annualized period ended 2/28. So since we last updated, the board was a year ago. So that one-year number maybe is a good place to start, but we're happy to talk about any of the periods. Your portfolio, we have both gross and net, so we'll focus on the net number. Net of our fees, your portfolio is up 23.8% last year, or the trailing 1 year through 2/28. Versus 19.3 for the ACWI-X US benchmark and about 24.1 for the value benchmark. So we outperformed the core benchmark by about 450 basis points, and we're essentially in line with the value benchmark. So again, a good year for value, and a stock selection was strong in a number of different areas. Our sector over and underweight, as Swami pointed out, don't have a big impact on results. But last year, relative to the core benchmark, which is kind of our primary benchmark. We expect to outperform both over time, but we optimize or our risk controls are relative to that core benchmark. And we're overweight areas like financials, which were up 30%. We were underweight some of the more expensive areas of the market, like Staples and healthcare, which delivered single-digit returns. So that helped, but also it's really the bottom line is that value stocks that are cheap on cash flow and earnings, led the market last year, you know, across the board. So we had a good year in your portfolio, kind of kept up with the value, but you know, keep in mind that over the last couple of years when value has lagged, we've outperformed that value by quite a bit. So kind of taking in, you look at the last 3-5 years, we're about 200 basis points annualized over the value benchmark and about 120, 130 basis points net of fees over the, over the core benchmark. So, that's kind of a nutshell of the results. And just a quick update on, this year. I just looked today and your portfolio is up 8.2% year to date versus 8 for the core benchmark and 6.7 for value. So value's lagged a little bit this year, but we've been able to, we outperform both the core and the value thus far in the first quarter. So, markets are off to, at least the equity markets, even though we've had a little give back in the last couple of days, your international portfolio has done quite well thus far.
Just a couple of points I want to add to what Keith said, just to emphasize our performance over the last 5 years. If you look at the five-year number on page 9, you'll see the net is your portfolio has done 4.9% a year. The ACWI ex-US is 3.6, and the value is 2.9. The thing I want to point out is that if you look at the five-year performance, you can see over the five-year period, the value benchmark has slightly underperformed the core benchmark. Between it underperformed the growth benchmark also, because the core is a more growthy benchmark. So this is a period that has not been favorable for value, not just in the international markets, but also in the U.S. In spite of that, we were able to add value over, as I pointed out on page 10, we are deeper value than the value benchmark. We are cheaper than the value benchmark. So the value benchmark is cheaper than the core benchmark. It didn't do well last 5 years because cheap stocks generally did not do as well in the last 5 years. In spite of that, our portfolio, which has even cheaper stocks, did much better. And the reason for that is because of the way we think of cheapness, which is not just based on, book or dividend yield or sales, because we focus on companies with strong profitability. It gives us a kind of a higher quality value portfolio within the value universe. Because when you focus on companies with strong cash flows, they're unlikely to be distressed, they're unlikely to get into trouble because they have all these cash flows coming in. So I think that's the five-year number. I think that's an important thing to note. The other thing I also want to quickly point out was on page 11, where we have the portfolio characteristics, and Keith mentioned that we are overweight financial. We are overweight financial relative to the core benchmark because we optimized to the core benchmark because that's the benchmark we have. But and financials did very well last year. But if you look at the value benchmark, value benchmark is almost 40% of the portfolio in financials. So we are obviously, because we are optimizing to the core benchmark, we are max, you can see almost more than 5%. The next optimization, we will try to bring it back to the 5%. So we are doing max overweight to financials compared to the core benchmark, but we are still underweight the value benchmark.
Swami, it's Ed Hoffman from Barris. I had a question for you. Can you help us understand that with your quantitative approach and your investments in countries like Russia and Brazil, Indonesia, India, how do you get comfort that the data going into your model has integrity to it?
That's a very important question. It's a really important question for us because sometimes garbage in, garbage out. So. It is important that you have to have good data quality. The one thing I can tell you is that we've had this emerging market product since 2005. The quality of the data has improved tremendously over the years. To a large extent, because a lot of these companies are, they're traded in those local in their local markets, but they also come to the international markets to raise capital for private placement and otherwise in the debt capital markets and so on. So as a result, the quality of the financial statement, the disclosure requirements, they are voluntarily kind of following the IFRS requirements and kind of the international developed market accounting requirements. So that has been very good. The second thing is that if you notice our valuation model, going back to page 5, you will see that the cash flow earnings the third most important metric, valuation metric, is dividend yield in our model. In the U.S. model, dividend yield is the least important valuation metric. That's what our historical analysis shows us. But we give more weight to dividend yield in international markets, and this is particularly important for emerging markets. Because one of the biggest concerns you face in an emerging market is a concept called tunneling, which is basically you have this company that has been, there's a promoter, there's an entrepreneur, they have a company in emerging markets, and the issue is fraud. One of the ways companies commit fraud, especially if you go to the mid-cap, small-cap segment, is that there will be this publicly traded company that the promoter or the entrepreneur has, and they will have another company that is private, and this private company will supply goods to this publicly traded company. And one way you can tunnel money out of this publicly traded company is to overcharge this company for whatever material you are supplying, raw material or other things. And this is one common form of fraud. There are academic papers written on it. And so one way that you can kind of guard against that is to make sure the company pays a lot of dividends. Because typically, people who are trying to take money out of a company will not pay dividends to their investors in a consistent way. So high dividend yield is actually a good corporate governance indicator and kind of like an anti-fraud indicator if the company is consistently paying a lot of dividends. The second thing that we do to ensure that that the impact of any such thing is not big on the portfolio is the diversification. Is to make sure that you are not putting too much weight on one stock, and that helps a lot. So even if that one name, if something goes wrong with it, its impact on the overall portfolio is minimal. So being diversified is very important. And the third thing is that we do a lot of cleaning up the data. When the data comes in from through the databases, every day it comes into our system. We have all these filters that we have built in that will flag us if there's something that looks fishy. And we can always replace that name with something else if we are not sure about the data. So data integrity, data quality is very, very important to us, and we take it very seriously.
Thank you.
Up against our time. Are there other questions? Or
I have a couple.
Spend a little bit more time on?
I have a couple questions. Darren Garrett here. First question, Samsung Electronics is the largest holding in our portfolio, 1.9%. Are you concerned at all about the recent indictments of its heir and top executives with the corruption scandal in South Korea?
The way this information is it's not direct way for this information to go into our model. The way we typically capture this kind of information into our model is through the sub-side earnings forecast we rely on. We have several sub-side analysts covering this company, and they provide individual earnings estimates, 1 year out, 2 years out, cash flow estimates, revenue estimates. And so we rely on them, and we weight them differently depending upon who we think is more reliable, more accurate. So to the extent there is this kind of activity, CEOs being indicted, or Volkswagen having its problems, or British Petroleum having a Gulf, having a well blow up in the Gulf of Mexico. Typically, what we do is that we wait for the analysts to revise their estimates, and they do it fairly quickly when these kind of things occur. We wait for those estimates to come in to the model, and then of course, everything is being recomputed on a daily basis. We wait for the prices to adjust, and then we see where the stock is currently ranked based on all this information that the latest information we have. Typically what we do is if you are in the process of adding to a name, or let's say we found it attractive and we're buying more of it or something like that, and news like this hits, typically we'll freeze the trading activity in that stock. Our traders will come back to our portfolio managers and tell them, look, there is this news that is out, what should we do? And what we will do is put those stocks in a no-touch list, and we will not double down, we won't add, we will just wait for the dust to settle a little bit and let all the information come in and see where the stock is ranked. And in the next rebalance, if it is still in the top 15% or the top 40%, the stock will remain in the portfolio. If it falls below the top 40% because of these news, then we'll replace it with something else.
Okay. And then my other question is, the UK is our second largest country holding. Are you concerned at all 2-3 years out with Brexit?
So if you turn to page 12, you will see the country weights of the Sansos portfolio versus the ACWI core benchmark. And you'll see that right now UK is slightly underweight UK compared to the core benchmark. Typically our underweight and overweight with respect to country is going to be within plus or minus 1%. We are country neutral. So we don't take any big country allocation bets over and above what is in the benchmark. Our country allocations are going to roughly parallel the country allocations of the benchmark because we don't have any country views per se. So we will continue to be around that, close to that 12%, 12.5%, slightly less, slightly more, but we aren't going to significantly underweight or overweight based on macro calls because we focus on bottom-up stock selection. And even if, UK has some issues, we'll face some issues through this Brexit negotiation, we are confident we can still find attractive companies within UK that are the best we can find there.
Okay, thank you.
Questions.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you. We appreciate it. As long as said up front, we appreciate the long relationship and look forward to future meetings with you. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Okay, we'll move on now to item number 7, Executive Director Investment, discussion and action regarding Bank of New York Mellon foreign exchange transaction litigation.
This is an information discussion item only. As you know, Trustee Lynch has some questions regarding Bank of New York Mellon, and in particular, the recent move towards funding Insight, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Bank of New York Mellon. And so there was two specific questions that were asked in that meeting. One, where in the process is the litigation regarding Bank of New York Mellon and their foreign exchange transaction practices? And two, what rules or regulations have been put into place to help mitigate the risk of a custodial bank misrepresenting their fees for foreign exchange transactions? And I am going to let the crafter of this agenda item, Natalie Elliott, discuss this.
Okay, first question, where in the process is litigation regarding Bank of New York Mellon and their foreign exchange transaction practices? The litigation is almost finished. Bank of New York Mellon has paid out over $1.5 billion in fines and disgorgement payments back to the clients for profits that they earned by performing these practices. The SEC, back in 2016, I believe, fined the Bank of New York Mellon a $30 million penalty and had stipulations for 3 years for reporting requirements by the Bank of New York Mellon. They had to have internal audits. They had to come up with a practice on how they're not going to be able to do these kinds of practices anymore. The internal audits are to obviously audit their new practices. And the internal audit reports were to be reported to their external auditors, and their external auditors are to report to the SEC any findings on the internal audits based on this new practice. And that had to be done for 3 years. So that's where we stand as far as litigation is, and that's what has taken place in the rules and regulations that were laid down for Bank of New York Mellon.
Natalie, the second, or that question indicates they reimbursed us $21,000.
We actually got another check this month, so okay. It's a little over $25,000 now.
And how much was lost? That's attributable to their
Our loss?
Yeah.
We're not able to get that number. What the Bank of New York Mellon did, as well as other custodial banks that have been fined for this stuff, is not place a timestamp on the transaction confirmations. They had the date, they had the dollar amount, and the foreign exchange fee that was applied to that transaction. But they didn't have the timestamp, and foreign exchange transaction fees vary throughout the day. So without that timestamp, we have no way of calculating or coming close to what our total loss was. Stan Serra was invited to be included in a class action lawsuit, and that's why we're receiving these monies now. So I don't know what the total loss for that particular class action set was.
But my issue with this is, it was always how we can hire somebody, who has cheated us, and who has deliberately and systematically cheated us over a certain period of time. And I was surprised when Insight was determined, it was, you know, wholly owned by these guys. And if you go on Google and you do Bank of New York Mellon, you find a series of suits. There's a couple more. SEC's kind of get them on a couple billion-dollar deal now. And there's another one where they cheated or they fixed an inside deal on some Middle Eastern country to hire their people as their interns for their some of their financial programs. But they're clearly edge operators, and obviously they're huge and enormous. And I see here in our value-added thing, we have them in here for another $80 million or something. I think maybe we should think about who we deal with as business partners. And I think that's an important consideration. Now, if they're the only game in town, that's one thing. But they're not. And I don't think we should validate people stealing from us. And that's what investing in a Bank of New York Mellon essentially is. So I thank you for your report, Natalie.
I think there's two issues here. One, the issue regarding the core fund, Bank of New York Mellon, is a direct investment with Bank of New York Mellon. Maybe you can shed, Ed, you can shed some insight on the true nature of the relationship between Insight and Bank of New York Mellon, because I think that's a little different situation than the core fund that we have $80 million invested in.
Right. So the loss that you have and the class action that comes through as a result of your exposure to a Putnam fund, which is interesting, right? So it's the Putnam Whole Country World Fund, which had a custodial relationship with Bank of New York Mellon. So it's through the custodial relationship that the loss was incurred. What we're contemplating with the Insight position would be an investment with Insight. Insight actually does not use BNY Mellon for custodial services. Interesting as it may be. So when we invest in Insight, that is a company owned by, in a financial structure with BNY Mellon. And so it's a financial ownership. BNY Mellon doesn't provide any oversight in terms of how Insight runs its business. They follow their own CEO. In fact, we met with the CEO during our due diligence. And so they remain an autonomous group with an ownership structure. That's not uncommon in the investment management industry. There are many boutiques that have a parent company that is a financial relationship. And so this looks to be another one of those. So it doesn't strike us as being BNY involved in the decision making or the oversight of the business. It's simply an acquisition that they made to grow their revenues.
Their logo for Insight said a wholly owned subsidiary.
That's, yes.
And that strikes me as being 100%.
That is the legal arrangement.
Okay, so if the bank gets fined by the SEC $5 billion for one of these other instances, what's to stop them from doing something to take money out of their wholly owned subsidiary to help meet that obligation? And how would we even know?
That would be out of my realm. That would be a legal question. I wouldn't have an answer to that.
Because I just think that the trust factor here is, they should go that second step to win our trust as opposed to us trusting them.
Well, one thing, to answer very a small part of that question, Insight will not be having physical custody of our assets. So if Bank of New York Mellon does something with respect to Insight and raided their coffers, I don't even know how that would materialize. But they wouldn't be able to touch our specific assets. Those assets will be housed at Northern Trust.
No, I understand that. But it's at some point they write a check to the Bank of New York for something, and that check is either, you know, $100,000 or $100 million, and our portion of that check comes from profits from our investment, right? Our or losses.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is some risk from us in that setting is my only point here. And guys, they stole from us. So I got a problem with that.
I don't think we should deal with a company like that myself. I feel the same way Mike does. They intentionally cheated us, and they're not people that you can trust in the future. And in my own business, if I had dealt with a company that had done that to me, that would be the end for them forever.
They should at least make us whole if we can determine what the amount was. And I don't know. I mean, we all have in our businesses, and obviously Jim and Jeff as elected officials and Darren at the school board, you know, you all have to do ethics courses and fill out those. Do these people have to do any of that? Do you know? So well, clearly this was a violation. Has anyone, like...
Well, I think Melanie's points that out on issue.
Well, a couple of people got fired, right?
Well, specifically what laws and rules were violated.
I'm just wondering, is there any clean bank out there today? I mean, we've seen a slew of these, you know, in the last cycle when we have financial issues. I think none of them are clean anymore. So that'd be just my, this whole industry was, you know, had major regulation issues.
They pretty much all had regulation issues of some sort, yes. It's typically a cleanest shirt in the laundry kind of approach in terms of they've all had issues, but which ones are you willing to deal with, or which ones haven't you been burned by?
Right. Or which ones have made you whole?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my that's why I brought it up before. I don't know if we need to talk about it more. That's just where I am.
Does anybody have any, would the board like to take any further action on this matter? I mean, we have agreed to invest in Insight, but we haven't signed on the dotted line yet.
Yeah, I voted against that when we did it, and I'll vote against it when it comes up.
And I will also.
That's the board's pleasure.
Well, I think we've had two board members and maybe others that would like to see it back on the agenda, so let's do that.
What particular question would you like answered?
I think it was whenever you're going to bring it back for funding, correct? The Insight
board. Yes, but we've already gotten the green light from you folks for us to go ahead and begin negotiations. And
I see
believe Kathy entered into a contract.
Yes, that we have approval to move forward and enter into the contract. So if we're not going to do that, then we need board authority. We need to be told to do it.
Now we're probably not going to fund the investment probably until early June or so we do have some time here. I hate to keep saying that, and I don't want to continue to pull the reins back on the horse, but we do have some time before we have to sign on the dotted line.
I would say bring it back. We've had two board members that have requested that. I think we need to honor that request. So let's put it back on the agenda for next month.
Okay, and the specific question would be whether we want to continue down with this engagement with Insight. Am I correct?
Correct.
Rick, I want to know, because Mike brought up a good point, is it possible to determine the amount to make whole? Is that such an intangible?
It is very. It's a very nebulous calculation, and I think Natalie kind of touched upon it. We don't know what the best execution was for each day. And, I mean, you can help me here if you like. I'm not an expert on this, but, I mean,
mean, there were probably so many trades, currency trades, during that period of time. I don't know how to unscramble that egg.
Time stamping is key.
Yeah.
Same with, like, when we go through a transition management exercise, those things are all time stamped. We watch transition managers get in trouble for the same kind of thing. And if it's not time stamped, you don't know what the price was when you transacted. And so it's just left open. It was during that day. Well, that day had a range of high and low, and maybe you were in the median, maybe you were the high, maybe you were the low, who knows, but that all impacts the calculation pretty significantly.
And that's one of the regulations they violated.
That's right.
Because they didn't keep the records.
$2 billion, they stole $2
billion. Well, that was...
Over 10 years from their clients, that's the complaint.
That was, correct me if I'm wrong, that's what the whistleblower alleged.
Yes.
So that's never been a proven number either. And they've paid out $1.5 billion. So that's probably a hard number so far, but it sounds like that's not even reached its conclusion. If we just received a check, that number is probably inching up as well. So.
Yeah. Can you bring this back? Can you bring back an alternative direction for us if we decide not to go inside?
Yes, we can, but I don't want to flesh that out too much because I don't want to spend the time doing
right,
it.
But right.
If you are still uncomfortable with this, engaging with Insight, and I'm assuming that you perhaps are uncomfortable with the Bank of New York Mellon core investment as well, and we would like to discuss that, I'm assuming. Okay, that we can definitely offer an alternative to, and that can be a part of our transition in the asset allocation. But drilling down any more on an alternative Insight, I don't want to spend that time yet until I know the direction that you folks want to go.
Didn't we have an alternative when we
did
it?
We did. Okay. We had a second place winner, right?
It sounds like if we had the right people from Insight to answer these questions, we'd probably be in pretty good shape. And maybe not, someone from BNY Mellon. I don't know. Yeah.
I'd be happy to talk to them.
Okay.
Tell them to bring a checkbook.
It just seems to me like there have been a lot of banks over a period of time that have had issues, that there have been losses by one group or another. If we start distancing ourselves from every subsidiary or partner of every bank that's had problems,
I agree with you 100%. But the issue here is, these people deliberately and systematically cheated us. This is not a transaction or a transgression that they made and got caught for it, and this is 12 years later and we're gonna hold it against them. This is something they did to all of their clients. I mean, this is like, you know, this isn't gaming the system in, you know, where you're
like
fighting your competitor.
Or Bank of America.
Oh, I agree. And Bank of America, Wells Fargo is paying a huge price for that right now.
And even in this, they weren't acting alone.
Right. There were six banks.
So,
Would we choose all six banks to not deal with them or any of their subsidiaries or partners?
Well, we would certainly choose one that who hadn't cheated us.
Well, I think we have an issue on the table, and we've asked for it to come back at next month, and we'll have an opportunity to speak more. But I think discussing it more now, since it's not really on the agenda, is not productive. So let's move on to item 7B, the auxiliary investment report.
All right, this is item 7B, the auxiliary investment report. I'll go through this very quickly. If you go to page 1 on that analysis, and I apologize for the pink strip down these pages. We've had an issue with the printer, but it's since been fixed. What you can see is that on page two, the total portfolio earned about $11 million in value. So it was a very, very good quarter. It was a good rebound from the entire year. On page 4, you can see that's the value added for the entire year. The total portfolio, other than the alternatives, actually lost about $2.8 million to the passive investment after fees. And then if we go to page 5, So this is the investment fee summary, and what we're going to do is, beginning in June, we've always had this issue that the alternatives lag the rest of the portfolio, the equities and the fixed income. So we had always been showing you the investment fee summary report for the alternatives for one quarter, but then the report that we showed you for the rest of the portfolio was a quarter prior. So what we want to do is we want to get this in sync. So beginning in June, we'll be able to show you all of these reports on the same basis instead of having this lag between one part of the portfolio and the other. So what we decided to do, or what I decided to do for this report only, is to show you, based on all the data that we have, the reliable data, we have 27 months of reliable data, and page 5 shows this investment fee summary for a period of the last 27 months, ending September 30th, 2016. And it breaks down those fees in terms of managerial, performance, other, and custodial. It also breaks out fees by asset class, investment discretion, and investment style. And you can see that the investment fees at Stan Sara Page right now on an annualized basis is around 49 basis points. I can tell you right now that in another report that we have, a third of all the fees that Stan Sara pays comes from the alternative investments. So a third of all the fees comes from about 15 to 20% of the total portfolio. I want to bring to light to you another thing. If you look down at the bottom towards page 5, if you look at private credit and infrastructure, you'll see a basis point calculation of 300 basis points for credit and almost 1,000 basis points for infrastructure. The reason those are coming in so high is because we are calculating this in terms of the actual money that's been invested by Stan Sara into these asset classes. And the fact is that right now we're paying fees on some of our funds on capital that hasn't been deployed. So when they calculate these fees, they calculate them on the commitment, and then Stan Sara takes those fees that we pay, and we divide that by the actual assets, the average asset value that's been deployed into that space. So that's why they look big. We've always seen this in the past, and they actually trend down over time as the fund becomes more mature and as all of our capital gets invested. That's why those look high. So here we go. On page 6, so you can see it shows fees by asset class and investment discretion. So a third of the fees is taken up by alternatives. And of course, no big surprise, 99% of the fees is by active investing. That shouldn't surprise anyone. And then we've broken them out by investment style there as well. And then finally, I think that may be it. No, on page 7, I won't spend much time here. So this is a more granular approach to each of the managers. So did she go get Mike?
I don't know.
Okay, we're all back.
Next month.
So we'll now report out from closed session. Item 10A. You want to do that, or shall I?
Did you want to read out?
Read out on 10A.
Closed session. Jackson Square.
Jackson Square. We took action on the 10A item.
I was told that we weren't going to be because there was fees.
That's right.
Well,
that it was a document for fees, so no, I was not prepared.
Oh.
Okay. Well, you can still report out because you don't have to report out the fees, but you can report out that you approved the proposal. What was, because there was
sure.
a motion to
sure.
approve the proposal.
I can. I just won't mention that.
Yeah.
Okay. Motion was made by Jeff Grover and seconded by Trustee Mike O'Neill regarding item 10A. To authorize executive director to enter into an agreement with investment advisory agreement proposed by Jackson Square. No other items to report.
You should, it was unanimous.
Oh, motion passed unanimous, no other items to share.
Okay, thank you. Okay, members form 11A, I think it's just correspondence that was included in your packet. We don't need to talk about it, so we'll go on to members form. Mike, do you have anything?
No, I'll pass.
Actually, we do.
I do want your opinion on this, I'll take a second. Gabe Rodriguez from Sackers is reaching out, and he wants to come and speak with this board about Sackers, to have a frank and open discussion about Sackers, what you guys like, what you don't like, and so forth. The only reason I want you, I'm asking you to tell me whether you want this, is that he wants 15 to 20 minutes of your time. And I know that there's been some discussion about Sackers in general, and I know these board meetings are going over what you folks like. So I want to make sure that you guys want him to come and speak, and before I offer him 15 to 20 minutes of your time. That's all I want to know.
I got no problem with that.
I don't either, because we've all had comments after attending those, good and bad, about how they can improve those conferences. So if they truly want to hear it, we'll give them enough that they can report back to their directors.
You guys okay with that?
Yep. Do you think it possible, could he speak in the beginning? I'm going to be double booked for the next meeting.
I'll put him on at the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Fred, do you have anything?
No.
Jim?
Nothing today.
Michael?
Yes, on the Sackers issue,
yes.
Someone from Sackers reached out to me, Art Kulik, and there's been some subtext stuff going on at Sackers. You know, the last time there was a challenge for president and that kind of stuff. Well, evidently there's been put forth a challenge for secretary. Art Kulik has been secretary for a number of years, and for some reason his name was not put forward. And so other boards have recommended that he be placed on the ballot, which my understanding is he is going to be placed on the ballot. And I think next month, we'll discuss who's going to Sackers, and I will be going. I would just recommend to the board, if you think about it, that we support Art in his effort to be retained as secretary. Good guy, straight shooter, and, you know, yeah.
We can ask him questions about this, but from my investigation, there are some political issues that are going on behind the scenes,
yeah,
that we're all used to seeing from Sackers, so
yeah,
there are some things going on there.
So, other than that, spring training was great.
Perfect.
No, nothing.
Thank you. Sam?
Nothing.
Mandy?
Nothing.
Donna? Nothing. Don?
As a reminder, your Form 700s are due, so if you have not turned those in to me, please make sure that I get them as soon as possible so that I can get them to the clerk recorder for you.
You got mine, right?
I am not prepared to say exactly who I have, but I do remember yours.
Okay.
So if you did not turn it in, please turn it in.
No, really.
But the other thing is for Sackers, if you are planning on attending Sackers and you haven't already told me, please make sure that you do.
You got mine, right?
Your 700?
No.
Your Sackers? Yes.
Okay.
And you for Sackers.
Yeah. And my 700.
Yes, sir.
Kathy?
Kathy, yeah.
Okay, great.
I did receive yours.
Okay, meeting adjourned.
Yours was the first one received. Donna's was the
first one. I didn't receive that one.
They just copied it.
Joan picked the right meeting to miss.
Yeah.
She would have been complaining.